for streaming purposes is the, which is fine for us, but if we set up front, then the microphone will pick you up, microphones here will pick you up pretty well. If not, I will translate so that someone listening in can benefit at least from some part of your comment. So that's a logistical observation to begin with. Let me also begin with a couple of pedagogical observations. I assume that First and Second Peter are not new to you, and I'm right. You know that book, this book. You studied before, you'll study it again. So I feel absolutely no compulsion to treat it like a loaf of bread and start at the first and pull out two slices and pull out two slices all through the quarter and finish with just the heel left. I have no obligation to do that. We're going to dart and jump, and as much as I can dance, we're going to move around. And so I say that to invite you not to be too simply linear in working through the book. Now, I do also invite you to read the entirety of 1 Peter each week. I hope by next week you'll read the whole thing again. And if something registers in your mind, then that's what we can work on. I'm going to turn to your initiative as much as possible. So, let's see what we can. Well, let me. A couple of things. I need to warm us up for a while. I've learned recent times that it takes a few minutes for people to get willing to comment. So I've got to keep going for a little while, but I'm going to stop at some point and just wait for you. But I understand that we have to. So I'll do that in two ways. I'm going to read a bit, but I'm also just going to ask you to think about a couple of places as we start. Right here early in the book, these are in chapter 1. And I ask you simply to look at these two paired passages, one in verse 3 of chapter 1 in the second part of the verse, and similarly in verse 13. And let's just see commonalities and differences between these two parts of verses. We can go either way. If you see something common to both, then we'll talk about that. If you see something that's different that you want to notice, that's worth talking about as well. I'll take a moment to read while you're thinking. Just read these aloud. On the left, 1:3, part B, according to his great mercy, he has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. Then on the right side, set your hope fully on the grace that will be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. You can't be too obvious here. Just go ahead and tell me something you see. Hope. There's hope in both, all right? Yes, but now we can build on that and see, though hope is in both, hope is different. Differently used in each, and I invite your thinking. Yes. Well, all right, we've got two R words in each case. One is, so resurrection, so let's think about that in time sense. The resurrection is a past event, and it's the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And here is the revelation. So Jesus is mentioned in both places, but there's a time difference. So there is a backward looking, there's a hope from the past tied to the resurrection of Jesus, and there is a hope in the future tied to the revelation, which is this Peter's wording for the second coming, right? The return, the consummation of God's plan. All right, thank you for that. Now, so we have hope in the past, hope in the future. Something else about these two presentations of hope. How do they differ? Yes.
Well, in the first one, the hope is living, kind of a character that we don't have anything to do with. God made that happen through Jesus. It's living already. And the second, we are supposed to do something with it.
Thank you. Thank you. We have Brother Rogers here giving us this distinction on the left in the past. It's a living hope. I'm intrigued. I come to the same place you do, but I come with a slightly different angle. We got to there, but you say the living hope is the fact that it's living is what makes it kind
that's
of...
Present tense.
All right.
It's already doing that.
It's alive. It's at that moment and continuing. The living suggests that, an ongoing life. But you also say that we didn't have anything to do with it. God did. And so look at the verb tense. We're talking, or the mood here. We're talking about He has caused us to be born. So it is passive, right? It is not our enactment of hope. It is God's work that has given us. See, we were able to be born again. And that's, remember, we associate born again with John, and I like to remember, in fact, twice Peter uses this same language. All right, so in the past, God acted, and we get to receive the benefit of his action, born again to a living hope. But on the right, Brother Rogers says, in his words, we have to do something with it. Notice the form of the verb on the right. English teachers among us, anybody wants to take a stab at it, what the form is? Well, it is future oriented, right? Because it's to set your hope on this future event. There's going to be a revealing, right, of Jesus. And when he's revealed, our hope rests in that. See, our hope rests in two events about Jesus. On the one hand, the event of his resurrection. And then the next is the event of his revealing, of his appearing. But this is in the imperative. It's a command. You set your hope. As Brother Roger said, you have to do something. All right, and so I think it's pretty interesting to see us in between. In between in time, and in between in God's action and our own actions, right? I think it's helpful to understand that we live that way. We live in between. Okay, thank you for that. It's a good. Well, Brother Bashir. Okay.
Compared to the one on the right, which is grace. And I know those two terms are often seen as being very similar, but they're also very distinct.
All right.
They're always coupled together.
Coupled together and throughout songs, right? We see them pretty commonly. Yes. All right. So thank you. So again, I appreciate it. You're treating this like we do some of our, I've heard this about eating crawfish, that you got to get everything out of there. You can't let anything go to waste. And here, you're not letting a single word go here. You're working it, and I thank you for that. And I hope you understand that it'd be pretty interesting to note what is the difference between those. Yes, Ruth?
This one to me says...
On the left. Okay, so the mercy is tied to forgiveness, and the hope coming from that, and then the one on the right then is the grace that is to come. Notice how we, an interesting twist on or addition to thinking about grace, is that here we have, we think about receiving grace in salvation, Ephesians 2, for by grace you have been saved. So we think about that's the language of salvation right now. We've gotten grace. But here we're told there's grace to come, right? There's more grace to be revealed on that day. So thank you. I appreciate that. We can just keep these words handy. In fact, I hope one way we keep them handy is to sing them. Another way we keep them handy is to pray with these words. And I hope that this week you can work some of the language of 1 Peter into your prayers. I think that might be a useful homework assignment. Thank you. Okay, I want to show you a list. Now, we're not really going to work on this unless we just have to, but it's food for thought, planting seeds, looking ahead to whatever time it takes to address all of these things. What I'm asking you to note here are simply words that get used a lot in this book. And you see that they range some, but salvation is mentioned here 3 times in the first chapter, once in the second chapter. Just a lot of suffering, a lot of glory, right? So you may already have known this, but apparently 1 Peter is a book about suffering. And so we need to understand how it gets used in all these different ways. The glory is in there a lot. And so as you read all of 1 Peter this week, I invite you to register these words as they come along. Just notice the frequency of nothing else. There's a reason. And I'm especially intrigued by the word called. It's not as many times as two of those others, but it's interesting how they get used so frequently and variously. So I invite you, this again is food for thought. All right. In fact, let me show you one place where the suffering and the glory are coming together. Look with me in chapter 1 and verse 11. Chapter 1 and verse 11. We'll see them both here. We'll just use this as an introduction to these words that are going to be our fairly frequent companions as we pass through this book. I'm reading again in verse 11. Inquiring what person or time the Spirit of Christ in them was indicating. So these are Old Testament writers. These were prophets who wanted to know, when is this going to happen? What's the time? And they didn't get to find out, but we do. The Spirit of Christ in them was indicating when he predicted the sufferings of Christ and the subsequent glories. See, that's a useful pairing. Because it seems to me one of the temptations we have, or challenges we have in trying to understand the whole story is we tend to forget, or at least perhaps if we don't, our religious neighbors might struggle with this too. Maybe we all do. Forget that the story has both parts. For me, the companion passage here is, of course, Luke 24, the road to Emmaus, right after the day of the resurrection. And these guys are walking along the road to the village of Emmaus, and what happens? Jesus listens in and says, what are you guys talking about? I'm paraphrasing. And they said, are you the only person who doesn't know? We're talking about these big events. What do these events mean? Right? We had hoped that this one, he was the one who was going to redeem Jerusalem. And then he died. We had a picture. We thought, he's the one. He's the one that's going to take us up into this exalted, renewed state. And yet he died. And Jesus said, you people who are so slow to heed the prophets. Right? And then what does he do? Did you not know? Don't you remember that the Christ has to first suffer and then enter his glory? So you forgot the first part of the story. You didn't understand that both are there. You just grabbed the part that seemed so promising to you. Well, here you see the same thing. Here the both are being announced. See, the prophets could understood this. The traveling disciples were more troubled until, we're told there, Jesus, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them everything about him, about himself. So, again, glory and suffering. We've got to see how those two pair. Okay, Time for me to pause. Is there initiative on your part, something that you've already gathered, something you've already encountered in 1 Peter that intrigues you enough to raise a question about it? Yes, Troy. Yes.
Kind of compare what Peter is doing versus what John does in the first three chapters of the book of Revelation. It's primarily to the same Christians in the same period of the world.
It generally would be the same. So let's go back and look at chapter 1, the opening words of the letter. Troy asked about this the setting, the audience that receives it. Well, let's just... There's really a fascinating list that we're given here of the features or the characteristics of this group. This is in verse 1. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ. 2, those who are elect exiles. You are members of what he calls, in the next line, the next continuing on, exiles of the dispersion. Right, the Greek word diaspora there, that's still a word used for the scattering. There are, I think, of three historical examples that are famously called diasporas. And if you ask, I'll tell you them. But one of them is involving these people. It is really the scattering of people, probably the scattering after the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 A.D., So they are elect, which means they have entered in among God's people, and they are exiles. Now, I don't know if exiles are this way. There's probably a double meaning about exiles here. They may be those who have left their homes because of the scattering. Right? That's what the dispersion is. But there's another element here, and this is something we might need to explore more fully, that these people are exiles by their social class as well. It may not just be a kind of a reference to political refugees almost. It may have something to do with maybe that and class as well. All right, so this is the group. They're exiles somehow, and here they are immersed in five places that are named: Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. Now, those are all five provinces of Asia Minor, which today is the modern nation of Turkey. And you know the seven churches in the Revelation are generally referred to as the seven churches of Asia, which is one of these five provinces, right? So it is locating people where they are, but notice... So he certainly wants to make this geographical connection, but I think the list that follows is what's inviting to me as what I want to think about. According to the foreknowledge of God, the Father, in the sanctification of the Spirit, for obedience to Jesus Christ, and for sprinkling with his blood. Four different things said about this group, about their... These seem to be more of their... Or at least some of them about their spiritual attributes, and not simply social attributes. So we can ponder some of those if you have questions about it. So this is called a general epistle. It's not to one place. It is to a larger audience, I suppose. They are scattered of the dispersion. Thank you for asking about that. Is there more you'd like to? I've already told you all I know. But if you have more, if you want to ask a question, we can certainly come back to these things and talk about them more fully if after you've done the research and can teach us. Any takers?
Could be they were exiles because of their relation to Jesus.
No, I don't. Well, in some ways.
Social outcasts.
There is an element of that, I think, that in fact, as we look, when you look in the heart of the letter, right, in the middle of the letter, there's quite a bit, chapter 3 particularly, there's quite a bit of what are called the household rules. How are you supposed to act as God's people? And you, the big part of that, you see, is how do you act around people who are not particularly receptive to you? Right? And so it is about exiles is not just having left some other place, but people who don't fit in perfectly where they are. And how are you supposed to conduct yourself while you're in exile, while you're an outsider, while you don't fit in, and you're not ever going to fit in. There's an interesting book written by someone not part of our fellowship, but a book called Who Gets to Narrate the World? What an interesting title. Who Gets to Narrate the World? So what kind of story is set up? See, these people are exiles in one sense because they don't fit into the narrative of the place and time where they live. And so what this book argues is that what believers in the first century did was they lived, 1 Peter, they lived in such a way that people marveled at three things. We believe, we behave, we belong. See, and these people, they believe in not kind of pantheistically or promiscuously just taking on all kinds of gods, which a lot of people would have done at the time. Add new gods, that's fine. As long as you honor the gods of Rome and the emperor, everything's fine. But here were people that know that who had a very definite we believe, a narrow sense of we believe. And then not only that, we show we believe by the way we live. We behave. And people are going to marvel at how they behave. And they're also going to say, they see, we belong. These people, they're together and they're taking care of one another. They're in a community that they're living well as exiles. So think about those three statements. We believe, we behave, we belong. If nothing else, it's a tidy six-word, tidy repetition. Thank you for asking. I'm glad to hear more. I hope you'll see that this kind of this social part and it's and how it plays out in the way people are supposed to act. This chapter 3 is a big one. In fact, if you want to read chapter 3 next week, we come back, we can jump right to there. We don't have to go in order, as I said. These are short enough books, we can look at them, everything, in as many ways as we need. In fact, if somebody turns there tonight, we can, I may not have an answer, but we can listen and we could go ahead and start talking about things like that if you need. Thank you. I'm glad to hear someone else who would like to pitch in. There's something that's just come to mind based on what you've said to me, but I want to save it for just a minute and see if there's somebody that will speak first. Well, here's what's intriguing, just a little thing I noticed, and I'm puzzling about this myself. I don't have an answer, but I'm puzzling. This is that repeatedly in this book, the writer tells us something about God and about what we should do, perhaps, but he's very careful. He doesn't always do both, but he's careful. I'm surprised how often he does one or the other, and that is when he says something, he tells why this is so, and he tells so what. He tells the what for, the purpose as well. It's almost like a cause and a consequence, and I wonder if it's not because something about their circumstances, it seems important to this writer to give that added, he's not simply giving commands. He's not simply giving information. He's trying to situate people. And here's what it seems to me, think about this just in the most obvious ways possible. If you're if you're an exile, either socially, politically, geographically, however you're kind of outside, it helps to have a heightened, an enlarged sense of purpose. I can live here at the edges because I'm part of something big, right? We belong. We belong to this community, but we belong to the kingdom. We belong to something bigger than all the troubles. You see how important that is. And I think Peter spends quite a bit of his work, even when he's wanting to talk about these very practical household rules. By the way, I can't resist giving you a vocabulary lesson. You know, the root meaning of household rules in Greek is the word economics, right? It's the rules of the household. The word, the echo part, and by the way, this connects us to ecology, to nature as well. Echo comes from the Greek oikos, which is a word for home, household. Right, and that word appears in Peter, in Greek, oikos. And then nomos, we know, is Deuteronomy. That's the law word. So economics is the law of the household, right? And that's what this book is about, the law of the household. How do we live? How do we live in the household knowing this? In fact, let me go back, though. Let me take you back to remind you. Think about this. See, that little gap between the two verses is where people's lives are, our lives are. And I can live that narrow space, however unsatisfying it may be, however challenging it may be, because I can look this way and see, I was born again to a living hope by the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. And I can look this way and say, there is going to come a day and there's going to be the revealing of more grace when He returns, when He is revealed. And I'm here in between those two. You see, that language helps to frame my conduct and frame my purpose so that I can live large. Think about that. Okay, well, we're going to come back to that. I'll try to show you places where it seems to me that the writer is specifically calling our attention to why something has to be this way. And in some ways, you think about it just the way when we're at our better moments, we explain things to our children. Now, there is a never-ending temptation. I even did this year with junior in high school, who dared to ask me, why do we have to do this? Why do I have to care about a bibliography on paper? Because I said so. Who are you? So, but we don't, that's not a good thing to say. But in our better moments, we do try to explain why, right? And how this fits into a bigger picture, which I did do. It didn't help, but I did it. Okay. So, let's go on to this little. When I've read through, I mean, my method was just to read 1 Peter all the way through. Then I back up and read 1 Peter again. And then I read it again, and I start marking things. What do you notice? And I've got my annotated version of it. And I just sort of see things that start repeating. And some things repeated a lot, like the list. This one is only twice, but I liked it. So I'm going to grab hold of it. Because it has to be, I assume everything's intentional. But when you have a doubling like this, I'm assuming intention. Notice what he says. He, this is Jesus himself. In chapter 2, verse 23, you can look at it and see if I'm right. He continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. So see, in the midst of his suffering, and that language right there, that's applied to Jesus. But man, what's to keep from that applying to me if I let it, right? In the midst of whatever difficulties I find, what can I do? I can say, I can continue entrusting myself to Him who judges justly. God's the perfect judge. Do I understand it? No. I can pull a Job. It's bad. It's real bad. I'm scraping scabs head to toe, sitting in the ashes. Got friends over there telling me weird things. Got a wife who says, curse God and die. And Job just keeps on scratching. I don't understand it, but I'm going to entrust myself. Though he slay me, yet will I serve him, right? I don't know if I got that serve word right. So that's the language we see. That, in, that, And so for me, as I invited you to use this in your homework of prayer, bring First Peter language into your prayer. For me, the word that's resonated the most as I've read through this several times is this word entrusting. And so I can put that in my prayer. Help me, dear God, help me entrust myself to you because I know you judge justly. See, what a nice little addition to your prayer. I invite you to consider that. Well, that's not all. Look at this. Chapter 4. Look at the language. They entrust their souls. See, that word entrust is there again. This time it's people. And that is the context of that, is it people who are suffering? Look and see if I'm right about that. I don't want to distort the context, but whatever is the circumstance they're in, these people are said. See, it's they. And they are doing what Jesus did. But notice the language is just slightly different. Not much, but just a little different. They entrust their souls, not to the judge. See, again, notice the doubling of time, of the time pairing. We hear born again to a living hope in the past, a grace to be revealed. Now we have one who judges justly over here, and now we have a creator who is faithful. See, once again, the language of the writer positions us, the readers, in between. And I can find my strength, I think, in part, because I can locate myself in that way. I can place myself between these two poles. I hope you see the power that's possible there. And notice how this is tied to their ongoing behavior while doing good. See? Even in the midst of suffering, even in the midst of difficulties. And notice this, if you were to pray, you could how you build both of these into it. You could say, dear God, and you could, I know you are the faithful creator. I know you are the one who judges justly. I entrust my soul to you. Let the rich language of First Peter help bolster your prayers. Maybe your prayers don't need bolstering. Mine need all the help they can get. And then, of course, that may keep us doing good while we're at it. Okay. Anyone, question or comment?
Frank, I think it's important in the first part of the verse, there's suffering according to God's will.
Suffering according to God's will. Thank you for that.
And then while doing good. Mm-hmm. And then that middle part, as you say, the middle of the sandwich there, is that according to God's will, entrust their souls to a faithful creator. So they're suffering for God's will.
Right.
While they're doing good, but they're entrusting their souls to God.
Okay, so Robert's saying that they're suffering according to God's will. That's the context. What was it? Not according. What was the word?
It says according to God's will.
Okay, suffering according to God's will. All right. So again, that brings up this question. There's a lot of thinking to be done about how suffering works through this, and how these people are working in relation to suffering. And I thank Robert for bringing that up as we here in this particular passage. We see this language of, in a context of suffering, two things they do. They entrust, and they keep doing good things. So you don't wait for things to get right to do good. You keep doing good, and you keep entrusting. Yeah, powerful language here. Thank you. Yes? Right. In his own suffering. So, yes, good. They're both presented in the context of suffering. Each is presented. And here, the sharp, horrific irony of entrusting your soul to a just judge while you're in before an unjust judge. Yes, thank you for that. I hope, again, you're invited to read as much of these as you can in the intervening week. and just let this language say, oh yes, I remember how we talked about this, and let it resonate. In fact, I encourage you not only to read the whole book this week, I encourage you to read part of it out loud. I think reading aloud helps. You may not want to read all of it out loud, but just maybe one chapter aloud and the rest silently, and then the next week read it all again and read a different chapter aloud. Again, those are just suggestions. You know how to study. You do what it works for you. Yes, brother.
Right, 117.
Okay.
If you call upon the Father, who without partiality judges according to one's work, to each one's work, conduct yourselves throughout the time of your sojourn here in fear. So I was wondering if this idea of entrusting or entrusting of their souls has something to do with the actions that we take, right? So when it talked about Jesus entrusting, it said, preceding that, it said, when he was reviled, he didn't revile.
Okay, so all right, so this is the first thing you want to talk about. The entrusting shapes his behavior, shapes the action, or informs it, which is another way to say shapes. And so we could see that to ourselves, right? If we really are entrusting, it's going to affect the way we encounter difficulties. We can suffer differently because we understand this possibility of entrusting ourselves. Thank you. You said two things.
And the other thing was, I like the juxtaposition of verse 15 with 17, because in 15 it says, but as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in your conduct.
Yeah.
And then in verse 17, it's the opposite. So in 15, it's God calling on us. And then in 17, it's us calling on God.
All right, thank you. Double. I want to, you remember called was one of those words that it's not there all that many times, but it is all through the book. And I want to wrestle with that. And I like the way you noted, it even brought out that fancy word juxtaposed, that we can see how, I really am interested in what this word called means in 1 Peter or anywhere. I invite you, there are obvious answers, and maybe that's all there is, but maybe there's a little more you might try pushing it. I've got one more, I thought. No, I don't have one more. Okay, this is one of the verses I think would be most powerful. We will certainly not exhaust it right now in 37 seconds. But I do want to show it to you. This is maybe another homework focus. Live as people who are free. See, that sounds pretty American. Not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. Now, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, this gets us to this astonishing paradox. We're free to be servants. So that's a puzzle. I want to work on that. So I'll just kind of leave that with you. So you've got several things. You've got that list of repeated words, some of the things we've read. I'm particularly wanting to go back to 1:15 through 17 that Malcolm mentioned tonight. And then this verse as well. You got several things you can think about. So if you can't read all of 1 Peter, you have these pieces you can work on. And then you're invited to work any other place you want. So let's close in prayer. Thank you for being here tonight. Holy God, help us to be your people. Help us entrust ourselves to you, who is the faithful creator and who is the judge who judges justly. We thank you for Jesus. Help us to anticipate. Help us to be eager for the revealing of the grace that when he returns. And help us to be sure, because we know that we have been born again to a living hope by your resurrection of Jesus from the dead. We thank you for this time together. Thank you for good people gathered to talk and listen to each other as we think aloud about your words. Help your words be our words. We thank you now in the name of Jesus. Amen.